The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, scientists are testing a new theory of how to look for life on other planets. And a newly discovered species of spider in the Amazon mimics an infamous zombie fungus. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Evidence of life beyond our solar system continues to elude scientists, and while we can use telescopes to detect signatures of habitable atmospheres, that could lead to false positives. According to our next guest, Harrison Smith, a specially appointed associate professor at the Earth Life Science Institute in Tokyo, it might be a better approach to look for clusters of habitable worlds in other star systems. I spoke with him about his team's work that tests the idea of life spreading to and altering nearby planets.
There's a list of molecules that people traditionally think are associated with life, and those are things like oxygen, or those are, you know, gases which are in disequilibrium, like oxygen and methane, for example. And so you have to not just come up with the gases themselves, but you have to come up with the mechanisms by which those might arrive in the atmosphere. And the kind of key takeaway with false positives is there's a lot of biosignatures that people propose that can be created by both life and non-life. So oxygen is something we associate with life here on Earth because, for example, you and I were breathing oxygen right now. But we can imagine that there's a lot of planets out there that oxygen can be created without life at all. And so the way that people are looking for these things on other planets is pointing your telescope, looking at either the absorbed or reflected light out of the atmospheres, and then matching the particular wavelength of light with what we know about those molecules. So identifying oxygen through that kind of way.
So because of the likelihood of false positives, it almost seems like on the surface it might work. Yeah, we're looking for signatures that we would associate with life on Earth. But things don't always operate or may not always operate the same on other planets beyond our solar system. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and kind of the key problem that we end up running into is that what we know about kind of what we think we know about life in general, or what we think we know about planets in general, we learn from our study of Earth. And Earth is, of course, only one kind of possible way that you can make a planet. And of course, we have other examples in the solar system like Mars or Venus, and those are kind of the common points of comparison as alternatives for other terrestrial bodies. But there's lots of different ways that you can make lots of different kinds of planets, and we have a hard time getting good data for those things outside the solar system just by nature of them being very far away.
So what your study proposes is the idea of looking for planets that are clustered together and share some sort of commonality that could therefore point to the possibility that life has moved beyond one planet into surrounding planets, or that there's signatures that are detected in multiple exoplanets at once versus looking for one, which might seem like looking for a needle in a haystack. Could you explain your thinking here in looking for a cluster of planets versus maybe looking for one world out there in the universe that might, you know, have some sort of conditions that might support life as we know it on Earth?
Yeah, the main thinking is, again, kind of exactly this line of questioning that you're asking, which is, can we come up with ideas of ways to look for life in which we don't need to kind of predefine what the molecules of interest are? So in the example earlier, that would be something like oxygen. And a lot of ways that people are looking for life right now is thinking, okay, if we can come up with a list of molecules that might exist simultaneously in an atmosphere that are really hard to fool us from thinking that they come from a non-living system, then we just look for a planet with kind of all that suite of molecules. But one of the downsides of doing that kind of thing is that you have to propose mechanisms by which all these molecules can be in the atmosphere, and ways in which You wouldn't get them in the atmosphere on a non-living planet. And those are all still subject to kind of the unknowns we don't know about how planets can evolve and how life can evolve. And so what we're proposing is, okay, instead of having to know all those things in advance, what if instead we take a different approach and say, okay, life might evolve in any number of ways that we can't imagine, but maybe one thing that life always does, or sometimes does, is maybe it goes and finds a home on another planet. So in the same way that here on Earth, we kind of expect that life is always kind of pushing its own boundaries and looking for new places to survive, maybe the same thing happens at the scale of the galaxy, and maybe life is going to eventually want to leave the planet that it evolves on and find another planet. And in doing so, maybe it'll make that other planet that it lands on more similar to the planet that it came from. This is a concept that people, I think, are familiar with from science fiction. You know, we always talk about, for example, terraforming Mars. This is a common point of interest where people think, like, maybe eventually at some point in the future of humanity, we're going to go land on Mars. We're not just going to go land there, we're going to make a base, and we're going to eventually make Mars kind of more hospitable to life on Earth. And effectively, what that means is we'd have to be making Mars look more like Earth. And so, if you were an observer outside the solar system and you were looking at our solar system and two planets, you would see Earth and you'd see maybe another planet that looks similar to Earth. And what we're proposing is kind of the same thing, but at the scale of planets across different solar systems. So maybe eventually in the future of humanity, we spread out across different planets. If the same thing happens across other life, which can emerge in the galaxy, then maybe it can leave this kind of statistical signature of life throughout many planets and not just on one planet, with one kind of gas.
So, in other words, you're looking for evidence of space travelers in other parts of space, right?
Exactly. So I think that, yeah, one of the things I should probably preface is I of course realize that not all life may do this kind of space travel. We don't know if life is going to go interstellar and this kind of thing. And so one of the kind of downsides of this kind of theory we're proposing is that it would require life which can travel between stars. And it would require life which can modify a planet. The good thing is we know that life can modify planets because it does that here on Earth, and we're already starting to experiment with how that would work. For example, if we went to Mars and in our solar system, the traveling between different star systems is the hard part. But one of the goals of this project was to come up with biosignatures which might exist, which would have less problems with false positives, even if it kind of raised the threshold for what it would take to detect life.
So I want to know more about your agnostic model and this agnostic approach. And understanding that from our conversation so far, it doesn't mean looking for that oxygen signature out in space. It doesn't necessarily mean you're looking for carbon dioxide. When you're talking about this agnostic approach, can you just give me a little bit more detail about developing this idea and how you put it to the test?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where the real difficulty lies. And so this first paper that we published was this kind of conceptual proof of concept. So we took a simplified model and we said, could this work in theory kind of under the best conditions? And it seems like it can. But of course, the model that we're running it under is quite simplified. We're not representing planets realistically. We're representing them as kind of simplified versions of themselves. And so kind of what the next steps, what we're going to do with this model are is connect it to more realistic kind of atmospheric modeling of planets, for example, to get a better idea of, okay, how can we look at this pattern emerging across many different planets in not just a simplified sense, but in the same, using the same kind of tools that modelers are using right now to understand kind of really complex situations in different planet atmospheric evolution. I don't know, did that answer your question or did I answer
Yeah,
something
I
different
think
there?
so. I guess I'm wondering how you think it may be improved in the future. And is this something where machine learning comes into place, or just a bunch of people who are really good at math? How do the nuts and bolts of it actually work?
Yeah, the nuts and bolts require that you have some way to kind of quantify what a planet looks like. And so I think the way that I imagine that in the easiest sense is you have some spectra which corresponds to a planet's atmosphere. So right now, that's often the way that we think about planets and characterizing planets is we point a telescope at the atmosphere and we get a spectra. And the spectra corresponds to kind of a forensic evidence of what molecules are in the atmosphere. And so what you can do is if in theory, what we're proposing is what you can do is if you get that spectra from many different planets and you have some way to measure how similar two spectra are to one another, we can maybe identify these kind of patterns which emerge where you have planets with more similar spectra than what you would expect by random appearing in a closer physical locations than you would expect by random. And that's basically what we're proposing as our statistical biosignature.
And I'm just curious about your own experience. Is there anything that inspired this work in you, whether we go back to something that you saw in a movie or read in a story, or just a general interest? What inspired this work in yourself and finding the people in your team to start thinking about this?
I guess I was there were kind of two things happening in parallel. One, I've been involved with some, other colleagues and other people in the astrobiology community who are thinking of ways to detect life on exoplanets. And I guess I was kind of always a little bit unsatisfied with the explanations people give of how we'd be finding life on exoplanets because oftentimes everything would hinge on this connection from how do you map the molecules that you find to actually explaining them as coming from life as opposed to something else? And that always seemed kind of like the weak spot to me for exoplanet astrobiology. And I don't want to be one of these people that's just purely critical without offering any other kind of alternatives of how you might do life detection on exoplanets. And so that was kind of a fire under me to try to figure out, okay, are there other ways that we can detect life on exoplanets besides these kind of canonical atmospheric biosignatures. And then in parallel, I was just thinking about this kind of, dream, which is often in the news these days from, billionaires like Elon Musk running SpaceX who say they want to set up, life on Mars. And of course, science fiction novels that I've read in the past, thinking about what would it be like if, humans went to Mars and we established a colony there. We made Mars habitable. And I got thinking, okay, well, if you just played that tape forward of what does that mean for what would happen after that, and what would that mean for what happens after that? And thinking about, what does that mean for how life can spread, not just between planets within a solar system, but eventually, I guess the natural progression would be spreading outside the solar system because you run out of space or you're just, you have curiosity. And so that made me think, okay, maybe that would cause, it would almost look like Earth itself was replicating from an outsider's perspective. And so I thought, well, maybe we can model this and maybe we can figure out if this actually does have promise for being a kind of biosignature.
So looking ahead and further developing this model, and it being right now purely in the simulation kind of realm, do you think that there will be a jump in your work in the future to actually put this into practice and put it on some telescopes and start scanning scanning space?
Yeah, I think one of the beauties of what we're proposing is it would be done with data that is already planning to be collected. So there's already, next generation space telescopes in the works thinking about how do we get atmospheric spectra from exoplanets, from varieties of kinds of exoplanets, whether those be gas giants or eventually maybe more Earth-sized exoplanets. And our approach would be able to take advantage of data that's already planning to be collected. The kind of, I guess, one of the big differences in what we're proposing and what I think a lot of people in the exoplanet astrobiology community want to do is instead of focusing just on getting really high resolution spectra of planets, which seem like they're kind of like Earth twins, our approach would benefit from maybe more coarse spectra from lots of different kinds of planets. So instead of having 25 high resolution spectra from Earth-like planets or Earth-sized planets, thinking about what would happen if you had, 1,000 spectra from other kinds of planets. And there are different missions that are planning to take these different approaches as well. So, for example, there's the European mission Ariel, and that mission in particular seems like it's planning to collect the kind of data which would be perfect for plugging into kind of our approach.
And I think you may have just answered my question, but what is next for you? And in the immediate future, where will you be focusing your research?
Yeah, this is just one out of many projects that I'm involved with. Of course, this is I really enjoy this kind of project because it kind of pairs together this modeling with also these, bigger picture questions. So one of the things we'd like to take and turn this research into, which we've kind of hinted at, is making it more realistic. So this has been a simplified conceptual model, and we want to take it to the next level by thinking of, okay, if we actually go out and model planets more realistically, if we actually think about what does it mean to compare two different planets in terms of how similar they are and quantify that, how can we do that in a more realistic way? So that's one of the next steps for this project.
Well, Harrison, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Harrison Smith is a specially appointed associate professor at the Earth Life Science Institute in Tokyo. His research is published in the Astrophysical Journal. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The video game and TV series The Last of Us is built on the concept of a fungus that can infect spiders and insects, making the jump to humans, creating monstrous zombies. But while the game and show are fictional, the parasitic Cordyceps fungus is not. And scientists have recently discovered a species of spider in the Amazon that mimics infected arthropods. To learn more, Madeline Reynolds spoke with Alex Bentley, a founder of Huasca Amazonia, a conservation foundation based in Ecuador.
So basically, these are fungi that produce spores that are airborne, and they go out and into the forest via wind. And there's millions of spores, and so it only takes one really to make contact with a spider in this case, or some kind of other insect, and then basically the fungus starts to infect the body of the animal, so it's going to start to spread out its mycelium, which are like its roots, and basically inside of the animal. And while that process is occurring, the animal starts to die. The famous example are of the ants, a zombie fungus, they call it, because it makes the ants turn into a kind of walking zombies. They start to act out and do things that are not usual for their kinds. And eventually, the fungus drives them into some kind of safe place. So, in a lot of cases, it's underneath a leaf. The ant will end up going under there, and by that time, it's sick, and it starts to shut down its body eventually. The ant or the insect or spider is already dead, and then the fungus has fully rooted itself, so to speak, with its mycelium in the body of the arthropod. Then it will actually, the fruiting bodies will come out. Fruiting bodies being, for instance, we most often associate them as mushrooms with a cap. These are not typical mushroom looking fungi. But they come out and they have their own fruiting bodies that produce spores, and the cycle starts over.
So, how was this study conducted into this specific spider that mimics that fungi that we've been talking about?
Yeah, so we actually, when we first found the spider, I thought that it was, some kind of exception in which the spider was infected with the fungus and somehow it was still alive. And so we collected the spider and brought it back, and pretty quickly figured out, thanks to some folks on iNaturalist and my colleague David, who is a specialist in these spiders, we pretty quickly figured out, no, this is not an infected spider. It is actually just a normal spider. This is how they are. And so we made as many natural history observations in the field as we could in terms of the micro habitat and the position of the spider, the height off of the ground. It had an egg sac as well, which was really novel information for this genus. Continued to observe it in the lab, so to speak, for a few days, getting photographic and video material until we eventually sacrificed it, needing a voucher species or specimen for the description of it, as is the case with all species descriptions. You have to have some kind of voucher in a museum. So we work directly with the National Institute of Biodiversity here in Ecuador. I'm an associate researcher, as is David. And so we were able to process the specimen in through the national collection and submit it there. And basically, once we had the specimen preserved, we conducted an analysis of its external morphology, describing its morphology. We had to do a number of different analyses, for instance, counting the number of spines on its forelegs, describing the different the hairs and the structures on the abdomen. David did open the spider up and did a photography and analysis of the genitalia, is always really important. And we also found ended up finding through another colleague of ours, Nadine, she found another one of these specimens in a collection in Germany. It was a specimen collected from Bolivia in the year 1903, so 120 years before us. And she'd seen it before, and I guess it logged in her mind, there's this weird critter, and she had no idea what it was. But we then figured out it was the same thing. We took also samples for genetic sequencing, which we haven't published yet, but we actually now have a basic phylogeny and sequences from the spider, which we plan to publish. And to the paper, we also added a description of natural history and distribution. And that's most of it.
And something that I was kind of like struck by is that this species of spider is able to mimic it. I think of how did they know to do that? Do they just, see this fungus and see that maybe predators see that and see that they don't eat those organisms or those animals that have that fungus because they view that as being sick or infected or dead. So do these spiders somehow see that and they're able to think, okay, well, I'm going to do that and then I'll have less predators? I found that really fascinating. I'm like, how were they able to figure that out, essentially?
Sure. So in effect, it's not really a process of them realizing or figuring it out. What it is a really long-term coevolution, basically, of between these two organisms, between the fungus and the spider. And this would have happened across millions of years, probably, where they were existing in the same area. And as we've found here in Huasca, there's an extremely high abundance of these Gibelula fungi. And so the adaptation would have occurred very slowly to kind of more and more and more look like a Gibelula because of the adaptive advantage that it has in the environment. And so none of the spiders would have actually even been aware of this. It would have just been something that gave them a slight advantage. So the more you look like that fungus, the more you're going to avoid predation. And in this case, the more you're going to be able to hunt successfully, because we identified two types of mimicry here that are occurring: an aggressive mimicry and a Batesian mimicry. Batesian mimicry is what we typically think of, like a coral snake, a false coral snake, and a real coral snake. You disguise yourself as something that is unpalatable or dangerous to avoid predation. So in this case, a bird is not going to want to eat this spider if it looks like a rotting fungus, a pathogen. That's not going to be a good food source, or even for another spider potentially. And so that's one deterrent. But on the other hand, we also have an aggressive mimicry in which the spider is able to capture its prey more easily because remember, these guys don't create webs. They actually need their prey to come close to them so that they can actively grab it. And it's believed that this genus emits pheromones that attract moths and potentially other invertebrates. And so basically luring them in closely. And it makes sense that if, you look just like some rotten fungus, a moth isn't going to think twice about walking by. And so it might be attracted because of this pheromone and coming up, and it looks like it's just a rotten spider there, and then it pounces on it. And so that's the advantage that would have occurred over all of these millions of years, that the individuals in the population that looked a little bit more like a fungus had more advantage, a higher advantage, and thus higher fecundity, and were able to pass their genes on to the next generation that then carried on that appearance. And even from that generation, the ones that looked most like it were also going to be more successful and reproduce. And that happened over the, course of thousands and thousands of generations.
Wow, and when I was looking at the pictures of this species of spider, I was like, ugh. It's like it manifests in such a way where it does look grotesque. So I would love for you to kind of talk about what the spiders mimic on themselves, because it's quite a look, I would say.
Oh yeah, it's impressive for sure. It's for most people something that looks kind of nasty, and for me it's just incredible. It's one of the most beautiful things I've seen for sure. Essentially, it looks just very, very much like one of these fungi with little kind of conical groups of hairs that look like basically the mycelium of a fungus. And then the two fruiting bodies, these two tubercles that come off of the abdomen. The spider also has two, its legs are very translucent. And so you almost, you don't really see them that much, especially during the day when the light is shining down through the leaf. The legs almost assume the color of the leaf, like a green, almost like a glass frog. And so again, that gives it that advantage of just looking like it's something kind of already rotten, moldy. It's a very wild looking spider with a tiny head and very long legs, again, for being able to grab its prey. And then that decoy of the whole abdomen that just looks like a, an infected fungus filled critter.
Alex Bentley's research is published in Zootaxa. He spoke with the best of our knowledges, Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1854. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.